Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoSillaCast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, March 7th, 2010, and this is show number 249. Well, this has been a whirlwind weekend. I had to record with Bart a day early and a week early. See, I have plans to be completely lazy next weekend. Steve and I are going off with our friends Dean and Suzanne to the local Santa Barbara wine country to celebrate our wedding anniversary. You may remember Dean and Suzanne as the crazy people who stalked us on our 20th anniversary in Sedona, and we actually invited them to celebrate our 25th anniversary in Sedona 5 years later with us. We decided waiting 5 years to see them was too long, so we're doing it again on our 27th, just for grins and giggles. And just to remind you, we have Mrs. Kravitz across the street keeping a vigilant eye on things. She's the most wonderful, nosy neighbor you could ever hope to find. Well, we'd better get this show on the road if we're going to get her done. Well, thanks to everyone who joined in on the Budsock contest. The winners have been notified via email, but as a special treat to those listening, I am not going to read their names off just so you can hear that you didn't win. Don't you hate it when people do that? You can thank me later. But if you weren't one of the lucky winners, remember, you can buy your very own Budsock for a grand total of $4 US at budsock.com. I still love mine. You should go get one. It's awesome. Well, I've been complaining to anyone who would listen, and many people who didn't want to listen, on this show, the Mac Roundtable, and Twitter, about my problem that if I start a video podcast on my second monitor, and then I forget to move the iTunes window back to the laptop monitor before disconnecting, iTunes somehow doesn't realize that the second monitor is no longer there. For the life of me, I can't get that video to come back to the only monitor I have. People have made all kinds of suggestions. A lot of people suggested using Gather Windows in the system prefs, but that does me no good because Gather Windows is not an option if you don't have a second monitor attached. And OS X understands that I don't have a second monitor attached. It's only iTunes that seems confused. Well, today, Alan Gabrielli sent me the fix. Here's what he said. I heard you complaining on the Mac Roundtable. See, I told you complained everywhere. Anyway, I heard you complaining on the Mac Roundtable about the video window in iTunes not relocating to the MacBook screen when you disconnect your external monitor. I have the same issue, but I found an answer. My system is a Core Duo 15-inch MacBook Pro, yes, it's that old, on an Apple 22-inch display. The solution for me is View, Video Size, Fit to Screen, also known as Command 3. I hope this works for you. Well, Alan, I can't thank you enough. Just to know that I'm not alone would have been almost good enough because no one else seemed to be having this problem. But to get the solution is absolutely brilliant. Thank you so much for the help. You're the best. Last week in Chit Chat Across the Pond, where Bart and I talked about alternative software, I explained that I was giving up on Chrome for a while because it was such a resource hog, but I was going to really miss the unified search URL bar in Chrome. That's the way where just you type up in one bar and you can type a search or a URL, whichever you want, and it just interprets what you're doing. Well, I had then found the plugin Omnibar that I was able to put into Firefox, and I had the best of both worlds, a more full-featured browser and the unified search / URL bar. Well, in the show notes last week, Bren wrote in a comment on podfeet.com after the show telling me something I did not know. Here's what he wrote. Regarding the awesome bar in Firefox, I think it's awesomer than either you or Bart realized. In fact, I think it does exactly what you wanted it to do, allowing you to avoid typing URLs. I haven't typed a URL in ages. He did it with three A's, so I knew to say it that way. He says, try typing dead air space, without the quotes, into the address bar in Firefox. It'll take you straight to Radiohead's website. You don't strike me as a Radiohead fan, so I imagine you've never been to that site. That's where I chose it, but pretty much any site title will do. It seems to use Google's I'm Feeling Lucky, so the results are probably the same as with Chrome. I've also almost completely forgotten about the search bar. Anytime I want to Google something, I type Google and Firefox Googles it for me. Ditto Wikipedia, Wiki, or IMDb, IMDb. He's putting those in quotes, and I wasn't quite sure what he meant at first. He says, or, well, you get the idea. I like doing this because it feels like giving instructions. So I think he says Wiki, and then the thing he's searching for, or IMDb, and the thing he's searching for, or Google, and the thing he's searching for. That's kind of a cool tip. Anyways, I hope I haven't misunderstood you and that I've just given you access to a cool feature of Firefox you didn't know was there. I really wonder why Mozilla didn't make a big deal of this, though. As far as I can tell, its sole discoverer is my sister, who showed it to me. Well, Bren, now I think I get why they call it the Awesome Bar. Thank you so much. I do think I still prefer the Omnibar plugin, and I'll tell you why. Because it does a URL or a search. The Awesome Bar does a search sometimes, but sometimes if you put in a term, like that crazy dead airspace idea, then it takes you directly to the URL through the I feel lucky thing. But what if I just wanted a search, like I was going to do a search, I was trying to find the lyrics or something like that. I didn't just want to go to the Radiohead website, like I would go to a music website anyway. Anyway, I'm glad you really explained all this to me. I like the idea that IMDb tip. We just live on IMDb around here because Steve and I don't know anything about anything to do with movies and pictures and that sort of thing. Moving pictures, I should say. So we could really use that. The other thing is, by understanding how the Awesome Bar works, when I'm on another machine, I know I can search without going all the way over to the right to the search bar. Well, this is a completely random thing coming up next, but I think you'll like it. Meet Sarah Jane. So I'm sitting in the Border Grill restaurant, and I have met a lovely woman named Sarah Jane from Ireland.
Yes, I'm absolutely from Ireland, born and bred, raised.
You're not faking, but you didn't know any Irish songs.
No, I didn't know Happy Birthday. That was the only, but I did remember how to say Happy Birthday in Irish.
Oh, good.
Yeah, but I couldn't remember how to sing it. But if it's someone's birthday, you say La Prella Honadit.
Say it one more.
La Prella Honadit.
Oh, I can't even start that.
And then another one is Pog Mahone.
Pog Mahone?
Pog Mahone.
Pog Mahone. What's
that? It's a very polite way of saying, kiss my behind.
Oh, very good. Thank you very much. Say hi to Bart.
Hello, Bart. How are you? Lovely to, not meet you. But
and where are you from again in Ireland?
Tralee, County Kerry.
All right. Nice to meet you. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Well, it's not every day you meet a woman from Ireland, so I thought I'd just throw that in. She was positively lovely. We adored her. About 30 years ago, my mom and dad told me to go see a movie called Murder by Death. They'd seen the Neil Simon play and then the movie and loved it. If you're a fan of the old 1940s murder detective books and movies, this is one you might want to see. It's basically a spoof of Sam Spade and The Thin Man and all of that genre. It's got Peter Sellers, Peter Falk, Eileen Brennan, Truman Capote, Alec Guinness, David Niven, Nancy Walker, James Cromwell, and more. It's an amazing cast. The people in it are fantastic. Anyway, Steve and I did go see the movie ages ago, and we loved it. Like I said, that was like 30 years ago, but this Christmas, Steve bought me the DVD. I rewatched it with my buddy Ron, who loves all those kind of mystery movies. Technically, Steve was there, but I'm not sure it kept his interest. Anyway, Ron and I loved it all over again. The reason I'm bringing it up, other than the fact that I can talk about anything I want in this show, is for the tech angle. Well, see, I was thinking I'd love for my mom to get to see the movie again, but as you may remember, she's blind. We could play it for her when she's here next time, but who knows when that would be. And since she's almost 90, I really try to kind of live in the moment, you know? So I got a great idea. What if I could send her the audio from the DVD so she could listen to it? The movie isn't super visual, it's the dialogue that makes it wonderful. So I thought it would be really cool if I could send her a CD of the movie. So here's what I did. I put the DVD into my Mac and started up the DVD player software. Next, I launched Audio Hijack Pro from Rogue Amoeba, and I told it to hijack the audio coming from the DVD player. Of course, at this point, it reminded me that I'm supposed to start Audio Hijack Pro first and then launch the DVD player. But it just politely relaunched it for me. At this point, it's hijacking, which is sort of like saying it's just listening to the audio, but you still have to tell Audio Hijack Pro what to do with that audio. In this case, I wanted to record, so I hit the record button. Back to the DVD player and hit the play button. Then, I went outside to play for a couple of hours. When I came back, there was a lovely hour and 30 minute MP3 file sitting in my music folder under Audio Hijack Pro. I then burned that to a CD as an MP3 file since it's an hour and a half long, and it's now in the mail to my mom as we speak. She's going to be so excited when she hears this. Oh, and don't tell the MPAA I did that, okay? Just don't mention that. Just keep that between us girls, all right? I love having my horizons widen, and the last couple of weeks have done just that. First, Matt, also known as Platinacat on Twitter, he did the review of Pino, a Twitter client on Linux. Well, that sounded like fun. I love a good Twitter client, so I just been to the Open Source Scale conference, and I just met Amber, who was bugging me about using Ubuntu more, so I fired up my virtual machine for Ubuntu. I knew there was this swell new tool in Ubuntu called the Package Manager, so you're not supposed to have to do all that scary command line nonsense. I typed in Pino, and it didn't find it. Dang, foiled. Well, I tweeted about it, and Matt wrote back and said maybe I needed to upgrade Ubuntu. You see, I was on 9.04, and he said that I needed to be on 9.10. That was the latest. Well, that sounded good. I told it to upgrade, and it started downloading. But it was taking forever. I started it up a couple of times, but each time it said it would take over 2 hours. Finally, when I was on the horn with Amber, on Twitter she's just me, Amber. Anyway, that was for her interview last week. She and her husband badgered me into just letting it run the stupid upgrade. She explained that the number 9.10 means the 10th month of 2009. So by running the 9.04 version, I was on one that was nearly a year old. That got to me, and I decided to go ahead and do it. So I ran the 2-hour upgrade, and excitedly, I opened the package manager, and still no Pino. Poopy pants. While Matt was relentless, though, he would not let me give up. He even wrote a detailed tutorial for me on how to use the command line and the advanced packaging tool, also known as APT, or apt, to install Pino on Ubuntu. Whoever said resistance is futile, though, has not met me, because even with the great instructions on his blog at binaryclock.wordpress.com, I managed to not achieve the goal. Well, then this guy Ryan jumped into the fray. He sent me a lovely long email written on his Palm Pre running real Linux in which he explained the virtues of the command line. He was so nice offering to help teach me and being so generous with offering his time to my adventures. Well, then the gang got even bigger when Bruce Barr, also known as Mr. Gadgets on Twitter, he jumped in on the pile. Well, he really didn't play fair. He did a tutorial for me using ScreenSteps. He's testing the beta of ScreenSteps on Linux, and he did a great job on it. The best news was that his instructions were how to do the package manager so that it would find the Pino package and I wouldn't have to use that icky command line. And guess what? It worked! It was one sort of weird thing to know how to do, but it wasn't miles of scary command line stuff. I'm so excited that I finally got this done. Thanks to Bruce and Amber and Matt and Ryan, we all got this done. And like I said, Matt for his persistence, because he was not going to let me let this go. Now I'm running Pino on Ubuntu. Well, speaking of Matt, how about another review of a Linux application?
Hi, Allison. Now, following up my last review of Pino, the Ubuntu Linux Twitter client, I thought I'd do a review of another app that I just found in the repository yesterday. It's called Kupfer. Now, this app is kind of like Quicksilver on the Mac, and its purpose is to allow you to find and launch applications quickly. However, that's not its only function. You can also do things such as search Google, or look up a word in the dictionary. You can search your file system. You could even, for example, search your contacts in Mozilla Thunderbird or Evolution Mail. It does have rather a lot of functionality, and I was impressed by its speed and stability. So, without further ado, let's get to the reviewing. Now, first of all, it's easily installed from the standard Ubuntu repositories. However, I discovered that the version in the repositories is a little bit out of date. So, you can install an even newer version by going to http://kaizer.se/wiki/kupfer. There, it has instructions on how to install from the PPA, and you get quite a lot of extra functionality in the newer version. Therefore, I strongly recommend installing from a PPA. If you don't know how to do that, please see the tutorial, which I'll be emailing Allison shortly. Now, let's get to the functionality review. Once you install it, a menu entry for Kupfer will appear in your accessories menu. Click that, and immediately we are presented with the main search box. From there, you can type in the name of an application, or you can try out some of the other functionality, such as Google searching. However, I warn you, you might not get the full functionality unless you do some configuration first. Mostly because there are a bunch of plugins, and not every single one of them is included by default. So, I would recommend right-clicking on the tray icon, it'll be whatever your search icon is, and clicking Preferences. There, you will see On the General tab, the option to make it start automatically on login. I enthusiastically checked this after about 5 minutes of using Kupfer. Show icon in the notification area. And what the key binding is. In this case, Control Space is its default. Now under Plugins, you can see that there are many, many. Such as Calculator, Firefox Bookmark Search, OpenOffice Document Search, Rhythmbox Song Search, and Thunderbird Contact Search. There are a bunch more, but I'm not going to go into them here because that would take forever to go through. So clearly, you can do just about anything you want to. Now, I presume the URL for Kupfer will be in the show notes. If not, here, once again, it is http://kaizer.se/wiki, that is W-I-K-I, /K-U-P-F-E-R. So, if you say that all together, http://kaizer.se/wiki/kupfer. Now, thanks for listening to this review, and chat with y'all next time. Bye!
Wow, Matt, this is so cool. I went into Ubuntu, opened the Synaptic Package Manager in Ubuntu, typed in Kupfer, marked it for installation, installed, and boom! I can now launch Pino with a single keystroke using Kupfer. This is so fun. Thanks for giving another great tip, Matt. Like I said, I'm having a blast. Give me another one. All right, back to business. Back before Christmas, I saw an ad for a Logitech lap desk that looked really interesting. I already have the iLap, which is a thin piece of aluminum, or aluminium, as the entire rest of the world says, and it's supported at the front and back by some large brackets with padding on them. Works great to get the notebook off your lap, it's really comfortable, gives great cooling, but it's not very portable because of its awkward shape. I was intrigued by the Logitech N315, and I was toying with running over to the store to look at it when Justin Byrne of the Mac Crack podcast stopped by and just happened to have picked one up that very day. I decided to wait a little while until Justin had used it for a bit to see if he still liked it. When I checked in on him and he was still enamored with it, I went ahead and bought it. Here's what makes the Logitech N315 so interesting. It's about the size and shape of a MacBook Air. It's got a really nice friction coating on it that's soft and like a real thin foam, really, really super thin foam. That coating has little tiny holes in it too. I suspect these are supposed to have to do with heat dissipation, but I'm not sure how much good they do because they're tiny little holes. The device does have an air pocket between two layers, so that helps keep the heat off of your lap. The other thing that makes the N315 stand out is it has a small tray that slides out of that air gap and lets you use a mouse when it's on your lap. So that was probably the biggest thing I was looking for, something portable but that would give me a mouse pad. I'm used to using the trackpad, but you know, a mouse is so much nicer. The one issue I have, though, with the Logitech is that I wish they'd put that nice sticky coating, that foamy stuff, on the mouse pad, too. Because if the lap desk is sitting on your lap and it's at all tilted, the mouse slides down, taking the cursor with it. Kind of distracting and annoying. Well, another cool use of that little tray came from Justin. He uses it to put his iPod or iPhone on while he's charging and syncing. I love that idea. I always kind of have mine dangling over the edge of the couch and hanging there. This is a much better way to go. Anyway, the Logitech Lap Desk N315 will run you $28 at Amazon. Link in the show notes, of course, to my affiliate link. But you can also find it at other fine stores like Target. I set online for as much as $40, but don't pay a dime over $30. Well, this week's Screen Steps ad comes courtesy of friend of the show, Kirshen. Let's listen to her review.
Allison from the Nosilla cast mentioned Screen Steps from Blue Mango in one of her recent podcast episodes. It looked like an interesting product, and knowing that I had a project at work in which I had to build step-by-step instructions, I downloaded a 30-day trial. It took me no more than an hour to get a number of lessons done, complete with annotated screenshots on the Power Mac G5 at work. These were to show novice Mac users, and our company is a PC-centric organization like many, and these were to show them how to start up QuickTime Pro and extract segments of video from a movie file. I also had a lesson to show how to connect to the network-attached storage shared drives on which the original movies were stored. Now, the trial is for the pro version, so I decided to export a manual of a number of lessons as a PDF to see how that works, as this is a pro-only feature. I was fully delighted with the results. Finally, since ScreenSteps is a cross-platform solution, I downloaded a Windows version so I could script a couple of lessons on installing and configuring QuickTime Player for Windows XP. Worked like a charm, and ScreenSteps even had the same folder format between Windows and Mac, so I could combine lessons developed on one platform with those from another. A couple more simple lessons to script, such as starting up and logging into the Mac, and putting the handwritten / PowerPoint slides, which I used to describe how to copy the video off the original video drives, and uploading those videos to our shared drives, and I'm done with the easy stuff. The more involved task would be to list out the steps to conglomerate 4 time-coded videos from 4 different video feeds using Final Cut Pro into one synchronized video high definition for analysis. The proof of the pudding will be when I present the document to the engineers who will be doing the video extracting and editing tasks, probably for the first time on the Mac, and watch them take the steps next week. I've since purchased the Pro version, and thanks to Allison's coupon code, I managed to save some money. Listen to a podcast to get that. And if you think that ScreenSteps is only for capturing steps for computer applications, think again. I've used it to create lessons which list the steps I need to do laundry, since I'm not the primary laundry person in the household and have to do that when she's away. Thanks, Allison.
Well, I'm so glad ScreenSteps works so great for you, Kirshen. This is wonderful. I love to hear the success stories. For the rest of you who haven't checked it out yet, download the free 30-day trial at screensteps.com and then use the coupon code NOSILLA, that's my name spelled backwards in all capital letters, for 25% off the purchase price. Next up, we have a review from Steve.
Hello, this is Steve with a review of CarMD, available at carmd.com. Allison received a review unit of CarMD at Macworld and asked me to give it a try. I took it for a spin and thought I'd pass on my impressions of the unit. CarMD is a combination of a small handheld unit and software that allows you to determine the health of your car by reading status messages stored in your car's onboard computer. CarMD requires a standard onboard diagnostics or OBD2 interface to operate. All North American passenger vehicles from 1996 on, gas-powered European vehicles from 2001 on, and diesel-powered European vehicles from 2003 on have an onboard computer and standard OBD2 interface. Folks from other countries can go to the OBD2 Wikipedia entry to see if their car has the correct interface. The CarMD box comes with a garage door opener size unit with 2 AAA batteries, a USB device cable, a handy carrying case, a simple 13-page user guide, and a software installation disk. CarMD is compatible with Windows and both PowerPC and Intel Macs. It lists for $98.99 US, although another site had it listed for only $79.90. So why would you want to use this device? Some of the stated uses for CarMD are to give your car a clean bill of health before a road trip, conduct a pre-smog emissions test to see if you will pass or fail, examine a used car before buying, or to solve check engine light problems. I dispute the last use, since CarMD won't allow you to solve the problem, but you can get information about the source of the problem. It also could come in handy if you want to get a second opinion of a repair estimate. You can compare your CarMD diagnostic report against your mechanics to ensure they are correctly stating required bills and billing you fairly. Of course, I wouldn't have this issue since Honda Bob is my mechanic. The gray CarMD handheld unit is pretty simple, with a small LCD display, 3 LEDs, 2 buttons, a USB connector, and a 16-pin data link connector that plugs directly into your car. I have to say the unit looks a bit like a phaser, but that's probably just my latent Star Trek fantasies emerging. One button is on-off and the other is used for scrolling through the test results shown on the LCD display. Results of each test are summarized by a lighted green, yellow, or red LED. Green and red indicate whether your car will likely pass or fail an emissions test, respectively, while a yellow is inconclusive and could result in a pass or fail. It's important to note each CarMD test is based solely on the status messages stored in your car's computer. The unit does not measure the actual emissions from your tailpipe, so CarMD could indicate a pass, but your car could still fail an emissions test. To read your car's status, you simply locate the OBD2 data link connector under your car's dash, plug in the unit, turn on your car without engaging the ignition, and wait for the data to be downloaded. After a short wait, a little less than a minute, you get a pleasing series of four beeps, meaning the data transfer is complete, at which point you can unplug the unit. That's it for reading your car's data. Next, you plug the unit into your computer through a USB connection and launch the CarMD application. The app presents you with a menu, including an option to get your car's diagnosis. Selecting this button automatically launches your browser and takes you directly to the CarMD website. It's at this point you realize CarMD is not a standalone application, but one that requires you connect to the CarMD website, register, and create an account. Basic membership is free and allows you to enter up to 3 vehicles and create up to 6 diagnostic reports per month. Premium membership provides an electronic newsletter, unlimited technical service bulletins, and access to warranty and scheduled maintenance info. It runs for $19.95 US per month. When you connect to the CarMD site, you have the option to sign in or register if you're a first-time user. After entering some information about your car, including the mileage and a nickname, the app automatically uploads the remaining info about your car from the handheld unit. You then can get a diagnostic report that initially comes up in summary form and includes a red, yellow, or green status of the check engine light, check engine code, secondary engine codes, and ready for emission test. All of my status monitors came up green, so I'm not sure what additional info CarMD provides if you have a yellow or red status. The report also provides the number of technical service bulletins and safety recalls available for your car. You can purchase tech service bulletins for $1.99 each if you have the basic membership, and they come free with the premium membership. In addition to the summary report, you can also select a page that provides status of many but not all of your car's monitors, such as the fuel monitor system, catalyst monitoring, and EGR monitoring. Several of the monitors are not supported, including the heated catalyst and boost pressure system monitoring. I'm not sure why some monitors are available while others are not. I've included some screenshots of the CarMD diagnostic status pages in Allison's show notes. So what are my impressions of CarMD? This system is a smart combination of hardware, application software, and web support. It's easy to use and provides good insight into the health and status of your car's engine. CarMD does what it's designed to do, but don't think of CarMD as a full-up diagnostic station. It does not have access to all of the information available on your car's onboard computer and does not provide any numeric readout of your car's system, such as RPMs, pressure, and timing info. It also does not allow you to reset any of the monitors since it's a read-only system. The CarMD software is generally easy to use and reliable with a couple minor complaints. One issue I had is the CarMD site is not structured to allow navigation in the reverse direction without using the back button for many paths. I have a pet peeve about this, so it may not be a big deal for you. Also, surprisingly, the CarMD application does not have an option to quit or exit. WTF over? You can close the window using the red button, but you can't quit the application. Kind of like Hotel California, where you can check out anytime you like, but you can never leave. I had to force quit the application to get it to close. Also, the symbols on the handheld unit's LCD display were too small to read without a very close inspection and good light. That may have something to do with my age and diminishing eyesight, however. I think you would have to have more than just a passing interest in your car's engine and its status to really appreciate this device and get value out of it. I did a quick check online and found a plethora of similar devices ranging in price from around $50 to $150 US. However, since CarMD is the only engine diagnostic device I've used, I can't comment on how its features compare to the others. Overall, I give CarMD an 8 on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being best. Bottom line is I think I will be using CarMD on occasion to check the health and status of my car's engine. That's it for my review of CarMD. Okay, Allison, what's up next to review?
Oh, dear, it looks like I've created a monster. Steve reminds me of that plant in Little Shop of Horrors. Feed me, Seymour! Anyway, he got some positive feedback on his earlier reviews. It looks like now he's out of control, or at least on his way. I talked to Steve a little bit after this review to try and understand how he gave it an 8 out of 10 when he seemed to focus on things he didn't like. Kind of reminds me of Bart's reviews, you know? Well, he really did like the CarMD because he personally does have more than a passing interest in cars, and he thinks that's important that you keep that in mind. I think he's good. It's good, though, that he did explain its limits. Good job, Steve. Well, maybe this is a good time to talk about Honda Bob. Instead of my regular ad, Honda Bob asked me to read something that he wrote. Here's what he wrote. There's been a lot of talk in the news lately about recalls. Let me try to explain what a recall is and what it is for. Whenever a vehicle has been in the public domain for a while, sometimes things happen to a vehicle that is unexpected by the owner. The owner complains to the dealership. The dealership reports the problem to the manufacturer. The manufacturer tries to come up with a solution for the problem. The consumer is then notified by whatever means necessary. The vehicle is returned to the dealership and the problem is repaired at no cost to the consumer. Occasionally, the government steps in and forces the manufacturer to repair or replace the vehicles in question. A recall, simply stated, is a device that the car manufacturer uses to repair or replace defective machines. Recalls are issued for numerous reasons, most importantly, safety. Automobiles are designed and assembled to very strict safety and manufacturing rules and regulations. The sophistication of modern automobiles and the speed that new models are introduced make it difficult for a manufacturer to test every system and every condition thoroughly, either by a computer simulation or real use. Sometimes problems arise later from consumer use that was unexpected by the manufacturer. A recall is then issued to repair that problem. There is a website for the public to check a vehicle to see if a recall or advisory has been issued for the particular vehicle according to the VIN, vehicle identification number of their car. www.odi.nhtsa.gov. Of course, there's a link in the show notes. It is then up to the owner of that vehicle to return to the dealership to get the problem repaired. Well, thanks, Bob. That was really informative, and the site to look up your car and check on recalls is very helpful and easy to use. If you live in the L.A. or Orange County areas, give Honda Bob a call at 562-531-2321 or send him an email at hdabob@aol.com. HDA Bob's mobile service is not affiliated with Honda, Acura, or Honda Worldwide. Well, it's that time of the week again. It's time for Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart Bouchats from BartB.ie. How are you this fine day, Bart?
I am fine. I'm confused. Today's Friday, but I'm talking to you instead of on Saturday.
And I'm not at the gym. I'm actually recording instead. We're being versatile with our schedules this week, right?
Yeah, wrong day and wrong time.
There you go. It's still time for Chit Chat Across the Pond. Well, let's kick in. What do we got on Security Light this week?
Just two items that have crossed my radar so far. The first one is almost comical. Don't look for any help in Internet Explorer, or it could cost you dearly.
Help?
Help, yes. There is a flaw in Internet Explorer's help function, of all things, that could allow remote code execution,
code execution. Just when you're at your most vulnerable?
You're like, I don't know what's going on. Yeah, if any website tries to social engineer you into pressing the F1 key for help, don't.
Oh, dear. That's so sad.
You pressing the F1 key to run any code they like on your system.
How long has that been around? Is that new in like IE8 or something?
Hang on, let me just double check what old versions are affected, because I don't believe it was new. It's certainly one of the more bizarre bugs. The document I'm looking for cannot be found. Oh, yeah. There. No, for some reason, the wiki has made a mess of those links. Stuck in hidden characters at the end. Anyway. Internet Explorer 6, 7, and 8 are vulnerable, but only when they're running on Windows XP.
Oh, okay. So you're okay if you're on Vista or Windows 7?
According to the documentation I have found, yes.
Okay.
That's from Security Focus.
But since most people are actually on Windows XP still, that could be an issue.
Hold on. I may have to correct myself.
Uh-oh.
Because on the discussion page, it says under XP, and on the info page, it lists as not vulnerable nothing.
Oh, no.
And as vulnerable everything.
Oh.
From Windows NT Server 4, Windows Server 2000, Windows Vista, Windows Vista Business, Windows 7 Beta?
So yeah. Don't ask for help.
So just, yeah, if anything, well, it's, if a site tries to social engineer you into pressing that help button, that's when they can get you. So ask for help when it's your own choice, but don't ask for help when other people tell you to.
All right. Sounds good. That's a sad little one. Any others?
It's a bizarre, it's one of the strangest flaws I've come across in my years of tracking this stuff.
Yeah.
The only other thing is that the next Tuesday is Patch Tuesday, and it's a small one, just two. One for Windows and one for Office. Both are rated as important, which is remote code execution, and both say they may require a reboot. And actually, to be honest, that annoys me so much. It's something they've started making fun of in security podcasts, that in Microsoft, they never actually make a statement. Everything could lead to arbitrary code execution and
may
could do
require,
something.
May require
and now it may require a restart. Either it does or it doesn't. Come on.
Depending on our mood when we finish writing this, I don't know.
Yeah, it's amazing. So this, just looking now, this bulletin affects Windows XP, Windows 7, and Windows Vista.
Okay, so just those three then. Good.
Just the important ones. And then the Office one is Office for Mac. Oh, interesting.
Oh, really?
Microsoft Office Suite and System Components, Microsoft Office for Mac, and other software.
Huh? What, which versions of Microsoft Office for Mac? I'm on a real old one. I think I'm in 2004.
2004 and 2008.
Okie dokie.
And the XML file converters.
So that means you need to launch those applications on the Mac because you're not going to get a Patch Tuesday notice.
Well, okay, I only have Office 2004 for Mac, and I only have it in work, but it installs a program that runs itself once a week to check for updates.
Oh, okay.
The Microsoft Office Software Updater.
Yeah, I must not be running that. Or maybe I haven't loaded it on my machine. Who knows? I use Bean for Office. No, but I have Excel running somewhere, so I must.
No, you must have it. It asks you, so maybe you didn't say yes.
That's possible. All right, so wake up your virtual machines, and if you're running regular Windows, do your Patch Tuesday, right?
Yeah, but obviously wait till Tuesday.
All right.
Because there's not much point in patching them before then.
Well, fine. All right, what else?
Okay. That's it security-wise, but something I just thought I'd bring up for the sake of completeness. We've been talking a lot about HTML5, and we had a dumb question about it last week and how it wasn't coming out, and we were all whiny about it. Well, this week, a draft version of the HTML5 spec has been released, and it is every bit as terse and detailed and not so human readable as the spec for HTML4 was. But if you care about the intricate details of the video tag, they're all here, including all the different options you can pass to it and everything you could ever want to know about it.
Well, there's people who care about that, so that's good.
Yeah, as well as a full list of detailed instructions on how to implement. Let me see, what have we got here? Case sensitivity and string comparison. Common micro syntaxes.
Ooh, I love it when you talk dirty, Bart.
Semantics and structures in the API of the HTML document.
Nice. DOM settable token list. I love that.
Tabular data we have here. Forums. Yeah, lots and lots and lots and lots of very juicy technical details that people have been arguing about for years. And to be honest, when you see the length of just the index here, you can understand why it takes a while to discuss all this stuff.
So that's really good news that it's out in draft, though, right? That means we're getting there. How long does it take to go from draft to I can has it?
How long's a piece of string? These things don't work to timetables. It's like the Senate. Unanimous consent and all that carry on.
Okay. Does that mean, but people are starting to write things to it already, aren't they?
Well, there are browsers already implementing it, so they'll be very happy to get it set in a bit more stone.
Right. Okay. Well, good. Nice to be kept up to date on that.
Definitely.
All right. What's our...
That's some timely news, as they say. Now, yeah, you had the idea for what to talk about, so...
Yeah. So you sent me a photo a while ago that I thought was really, really cool. Actually, I said it was a green train. It's not a green train. But it was a picture of a train above a canal with some grassy type stuff underneath it. And the train was in super, super sharp, beautiful focus. And the colors were all really vivid. But everything else was blurring as though it was flying by. And it was just a real interesting, as though you had taken the picture focusing on a speeding train, and so the train was frozen, but everything else was, streaked like it was going by. And I wanted to know how you did that, because I had a feeling you did it from a still photo, or the train was not zooming by.
It was zooming a little by, but I had, I had tried to make the panning blur, and to do that, you basically set the camera to shutter priority so that all the rest is done automatically, and you tell it what shutter speed to use, and it will adjust the aperture and everything. And I'd use that to try get motion blur. So basically, you'd set it as low as you possibly can, put the camera on autofocus and rapid fire mode, and just track with the train firing constantly and hoping that one of your 20 shots is decent.
Okay.
And that gave it a little bit of blur, but it didn't really have the effect I wanted. So, to the rescue comes Photoshop Elements, or your favorite editor of choice. I did it in Photoshop Elements mainly because I was trying to use Elements.
Uh-huh.
So it was a good way to test Elements, really, more than anything else. So the idea is that you have something moving, and you want to give motion blur. So motion blur is not a blur in all directions, it's a blur in one direction. So it's as if you were to hold down the shutter and spin around very fast, everything would be stretched out left to right, but it wouldn't be stretched out up and down.
Okay, that makes sense.
So, because that gives the impression then of speed.
Right.
So what we want to do is want to add a bit more speed to the train. So the first step is to use the fantastic Magic Wand Selection tool, and it really is fantastic in Photoshop Elements. And you just literally select the whole train. So you draw, you start clicking. Basically, the way the magic wand works is it tries to select everything until it finds an edge. So you click somewhere in the train and you start dragging, and it very quickly jumps out to the edges of the train. And then you move into the carriage and do the same. And then you move into the reflection of the train, which you also have to capture. Otherwise, you have a very bizarre
good point.
Effect. Oh, yeah, I found it out the hard way. What I also discovered was the steam was already blurry enough all by itself, so I didn't actually have to try to select the steam, which is lucky, because that would not have been fun. So you select it all with the magic wand tool, and you will invariably, it will select too much. Don't worry. Overdo it. Go outside the lines. Doesn't matter.
Color outside the lines? That's crazy.
Yeah, because what you do then is you hold down the command key, or was it the control key? Oh, sugar. There's a video of this in action, by the way, so
okay.
If I get it slightly wrong, it's not an issue. But there's a modifier key you press, and the plus icon changes to a minus icon, which is how you know you're holding down the right key. And then it has the opposite effect, it subtracts. So then you start on the sky and you color in, and very, very quickly everything will just snap
into place. Okay, good. Because really the contrast is really good on the on the sky, for example.
Yeah, so the edge between the sky and the train is very clear. And in my case, I had a house in the background, and so its edge confused it a bit, and it went, oh, you must want to select this house too. But as soon as I clicked on the house, it went, oh, no, you don't, and it snapped back to the train. So it's actually really quite good. And just by, holding down the modifier key to get the minus sign and just removing what little bits of extra seep in, it's actually surprisingly good.
Okay.
I was most pleasantly impressed, actually, with that tool.
Now, are you using a pen tablet while you're doing this, or are you doing it with the mouse?
I was just using the mouse.
Okay.
I have a pen tablet. I don't know where I got that from. Can't imagine. I just use the mouse.
It's right there.
It's right there. And you're not doing any precision work with this. You're just very roughly selecting with the magic wand tool.
Okay.
You could just use that selection, but what you get then is a really hard edge between what you selected and what you haven't. And the real world isn't all that big on hard edges. So instead, what you can do is there's an option to refine your selection. I think it's in Select, Refine Selection.
Okay.
And that lets you expand it slightly and then feather it.
Okay. I remember the feather deal that you could do. Basically takes like a fuzzy edge around it, kind of.
Yeah. So you have sliders, and if your one slider increases the selection and the other slider makes it fuzzy, and then there's another slider to straighten out wobbly edges.
Okay.
So if you're drawing, if you're drawing a selection, you're not going to get a very straight, you're not going to get a very good drawing of it, so you can sort of use that to correct your wobbliness.
Oh, that's
which isn't going to be the case here.
Okay.
So once you do that, you then want to create a new layer above the layer that you've done all the selecting on. And then when you created that layer, go back into the bottom layer and just say edit copy. Then select the top layer and go edit paste. And the idea is,
I usually do that just by, once I've selected it, I say edit copy, edit paste, and it creates the new layer.
Does it?
Yeah.
Okay.
It makes a layer all by itself.
Versions, because I've had it where it just plops it back onto my layer. Ah. It's like, okay, I have two copies of it here. That's not what I wanted.
Right.
So it's basically, the idea is you want the train on its own, or the car, or whatever it is you're trying to make look like it's moving really fast. You want that on its own on the top layer.
Right.
And then we're going to blur the bottom layer.
Okay.
Now, what you would imagine at this stage is that all you have to do is apply a pan blur, which is in the filters menu under blur, to the bottom layer and you'd be done. But you'd be wrong.
Horribly, horribly wrong, huh? Okay.
Not horribly, but subtly. Because what's really happening if a train is actually going by very fast is what's being blurred is only the background. Whereas if you just apply the blur to the whole layer, it's going to blur the train. And so at either side of the train is going to be copies of the train blurred. And that doesn't happen.
Well, wait a minute, but our train is on the top layer and it's not blurred. So if you're blurring the layer underneath it.
A copy of the train on the top layer.
Right.
It's still on the bottom layer. If we delete it, then we end up with...
Oh, because the blur is actually smearing it, kind of.
The blur smears, yeah.
Yeah,
so it takes bits
okay.
from every side and pulls it sideways. So the train gets blurred out beyond the edges of the sharp copy of the train. And so you have this horrible ghosting on the left and right side of everything.
Okay.
And nothing is perfectly smooth. So in the case of my train... You have a funnel where the steam comes out and it gets horribly blurred, and then the front of the train gets horribly blurred and the front of the carriage. And it looks, you know, if you stand back from it very far, it looks just fine.
That's not what you're going for.
No, and it looks very fake when you do it, like when you do that. So you can't just apply the blur straight off. You have to do a little more work. The way I do the work, what I do here is I duplicate the layer so that I don't damage my original photograph. I always like to keep it at the very bottom layer, completely untouched.
Right.
So I just duplicate that layer and have it in the middle. So your original is at the bottom and we're not going to touch it. Your train on its own is at the top.
Okay.
And we're going to hide it for now so it's just not in our view.
Oh, okay.
The reason will become obvious in a moment, and I drove myself potty for a moment before I realized what I was doing wrong. So we get to that. So you want this layer in the middle. And it's just going to be an exact copy, so just duplicate layer.
So it looks like you haven't done anything yet.
It looks like you haven't done anything. And what we're going to do is use the clone and stamp tool to clone in to the train on all vertical edges. So if it's passing by a tree, you clone that tree in a bit, which means when you blur it, you get blurred tree, not blurred train.
Wait a minute. So there's a tree behind the train. You've got some air gap between the back of the train and the tree. You're going to smear the tree towards the
train? Okay. So whatever is just to the left or just to the right of any vertical surface,
okay,
we're going to clone that into the left and into the right so that when we apply the blur, we're blurring what we've cloned, not the train.
Okay, and this is going to be tough for people who aren't looking at this, but so there's a train, then
there's an
air gap to the left, and then there's a tree. Are you saying you're going to, so the tree is to the left of the train, are you going to clone it towards the train or away from the train?
You're going to clone whatever is right next to the train into the train.
Towards the train. Okay, so from the front back and from the back front. Okay.
So at the very back, you'll see it touches the bush, so clone the bush in, and then it has sort of a tree that's almost semi-transparent, so clone that in. At the funnels, you have sky, so clone in the sky left and right. There's a bit there with a house. Clone in the house left into the train and right into the carriage. Whatever is vertically next to a straight face, clone it inward from each side. Hmm. And then when you apply the blur that stretches that out, you're having sky stretched rather than train stretched, or bush stretched rather than train stretched, or house stretched rather than train stretched, which is exactly what would happen in real life.
Okay.
Now, the reason I say you have to hide the top layer, because you're going to select your clone and stamp tool, you're going to pick your source, you're going to try coloring in. If the top layer is visible, you're going to go mad and think that the stamp and clone tool is broken.
So
because your pristine copy of the train is hovering over it.
Right, right, right.
And you don't see that you're cloning in behind that. So that's why you have to hide the top layer.
I've been doing cloning with Photoshop Elements and other tools for like 5 or 6 years, and I still can't tell you how many times I'm doing that going, why isn't it doing anything? I'm on the wrong layer.
Yeah. So hide the top layer, make sure you've selected the second layer, and then do your sample cloning. And go in, I mean, you're going to choose in the blur how many pixels to blur, so go in at least that many pixels.
Okay.
I usually clone in. I clone in way too far. And you don't have to be particularly careful because you're going to blur the hell out of all this anyway.
Right, right.
So you're not going for picture perfect. You're going for, once I blur it, will it look realistic? which means it can be quite... The only thing you have to be careful of is the sky. Don't pick a bit of sky that's too far away because sky tends to be gradiated.
Yeah, and it can get real weird looking.
It gets real weird looking if you have dark sky, then light sky, then dark sky, because that's not how skies work.
So the sky isn't end up going to get motion blurred, is it?
Well, it is, but you don't notice it.
Okay.
Solid blue that's been blurred is solid blue.
Right, except like you said, it's got gradations in it usually.
Yeah, so really what you're trying to do is select your source and then move exactly horizontally.
Okay.
And that way you're always going to be cloning in the gradients just right.
Okay, and the gradients in the sky tend to be up and down, not side to side.
The gradients are up and down. So you just select your source and you clone straight in with it, and then select a source from the other side and clone straight in with it. And if you always go straight in left and right, then you're fine.
Okay, now you might be in trouble if you had clouds in a picture.
Not really, because they're going to get the crap blurred out of them as well.
So oh, they are?
Clone them in.
Oh.
Yeah. Because if you think about it, as you're panning
that's
the camera.
That's true, it would be blurred. Yeah. Okay, I got you. I misunderstood.
So just whatever happens to be there, just clone it in left and clone it in right.
Okay.
At all vertical surfaces, and you have to be really careful. And I should also have mentioned that when you were doing your initial selection, be very careful you don't miss bits. Because you really don't want a funnel to be blurred while the rest of the train is sharp.
Is that from specific experience?
Specific experience.
The funnel got left behind, huh?
Well, it wasn't the funnel. If you look at the at the cab, there's this funny little vertical bar.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a whistle. I left that behind the first time and ended up with it blurred across everything. And it just looked really weird. Really weird.
Now, assuming that we don't know what we're doing the first time we try to replicate what you're doing, would you be able to go back and just fetch that that funnel from the bottom layer, do a copy of it, mm-hmm. paste it back on that top layer, and now you've got it?
Yes.
So you don't have to start over and say, oh, I got to select the whole train again, and I did all my
cloning. No, it's a good idea. What I found to make it easier to prove to yourself you're right is when you have the new top layer created with just the train, hide the bottom layer for a second and see if
anything's missing.
If the right amount vanishes.
Right.
Exactly the right amount and nothing more than the right amount.
Okay, so we've got a crisp train on the top layer. We've got the cloned in stuff on the middle layer and then the pristine version on the bottom. What's next?
Yeah, and the pristine version stays untouched. So we select our middle layer and we go to filter, blur, motion blur. We make sure the direction of the blur is in the direction the object is moving, which 99.99% of time is going to be horizontal.
One would hope with a train.
With a train, certainly, unless you're going for very arty sort of slanted framing, which actually could just really make a mess. And so you don't want to do that. Or I guess if you're looking at something being launched up into the air, then I guess up. But that'll just be weird.
A rocket, maybe.
Yeah, maybe if you tried to do one of, like, Cape Canaveral and you had, like, a four-minute exposure or something. Yeah, no, we're just getting silly here.
Okay.
So, it's going to be horizontal.
Okay, got it.
And so you select a direction, and then you select the amount, and that's just trial and error. So you try it, see if you like it, Control-Z if you don't, or Command-Z, sorry.
Have we turned our top layer back on yet?
No, keep it off for now so you can see what the blur is doing.
Okay.
And then the last thing you do is you just turn back on the top layer and hopefully a perfect result springs out at you.
Wow. I've got to give this a try. This sounds really fun.
Yeah, it's a good basic technique for learning how to work with layers.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And teaching yourself to remember to always be on the right layer, to remember that you can hide and unhide layers that you don't want in your way. It's just good. It's a good little exercise for getting good with layers. And once you're good with layers, you're a hell of a lot further on in your photoshopping ability.
You know, a lot of people, when I took all those pictures of the kids in cross country when Kyle was in high school, they were like, you're the most amazing photographer. It's like, no, I'm kind of good at Photoshop elements,
Yeah.
Especially cropping.
Fixing blemishes. And,
oh, yeah.
Cropping makes such a difference. It's unbelievable.
Oh, yeah. And that's why it's nice to have a camera with a reasonable amount of resolution so that you can zoom in. And, you know, all the kids use them for Facebook pictures anyway, so they don't care if what I give them in the end is 72 dpi. They don't care, so it makes a huge difference in how they look in the photo, that sort of thing.
Well, the other thing you have going for you is that you like to shoot with the zoom, mm-hmm. so you get the nice compressed depth of field, so you have sharp kid, blurry background, and immediately that makes you look like a genius from the newspapers.
Yeah, that's true. What I need to do is buy one of those, you know, $900 zoom lenses, though, so that I could take pictures when it was dusk. Nothing comes out in the late afternoon for me.
Yeah, because you have the same zoom as me, don't you?
Yeah, never bought anything else.
which if you're zoomed in all the way gives you a whoppingly dark f5.6. you basically, if you had a giant search lamp on your head, you might be able to do something.
Exactly. That's just about it. And I've never bought that.
No, but the downside, if you buy an f2.8 or something bright, what you're then going to need is a giant big tripod or someone to hold it for you.
Because I'm not going to be able to lift it.
Because there's going to be a hell of a lot of glass to let that much light in at 200, 300 millimeters.
I remember when Robert Lachman came over to visit and let me wax his car. He opens his trunk, and I mean, the lens, I swear to you, it was the width of the car. I mean, this was just, I could have lived in it for a few months. It was unbelievable.
Yeah. If you get a bright, they call it a bright lens because it lets in a lot of light so you can work in darkness.
Right.
A bright zoom lens, the acres of glass inside these things, huge wide openings at the front. I mean, you've seen the paparazzi. You know, yeah. I mean, the difference between their lens when they're at the, you know, taking photos of the tennis or the football match and your lens, they're not zooming in any more than you are, but they're doing it in the dark. Ugh. And their images are coming out. And it's because of these giant lenses gathering in bucketfuls of light.
Right, right. You know, you mentioned the paparazzi.
And each lens is worth about as much as a car. Well, no. Actually, some of them are worth about as much as a cheap car.
Jeez. You mentioned the paparazzi. I was watching the Mr. Toyota from Toyota up there on in the newspaper, and there were a couple of pictures of him sitting at this table with this grimace on his face as he testified and everything, and you know, it's just him alone at a table.
Just couldn't stop himself.
Yeah, but then there was a shot looking down the table with him on the left, and there were like 900 cameras focused on him. And you never think about the fact that you see this great photo in the LATimes.com website or wherever, you know, how many different people were taking that same photo, and you suddenly realize what was in his face was, I mean, just this sea of cameras. You know, you don't think about what their view is very often, you know, because you always see them by themselves. So
no, that's a good point, because you do often think that they've been copying from each other, but they weren't. They were just standing about 2 inches from the other guy.
Exactly. Well, this is a pretty cool tip. Anything else to tell us about this?
Okay, I suppose we should mention there's a video of it on the Typical Shutterbug website. So if we've lost you with our descriptions, you can watch it. Now, the quality of the flash version is interesting.
Not quite what you're hoping for.
No, but then again, I guess the choice is either have a giant mega file that no one's going to want to download or have poorer quality. But you do hear me narrating through it, so even if it's not entirely clear what I'm doing, hopefully what I say makes it clearer.
There you go. I bet it's great. All right, Bert. Well, I appreciate you going through this with us. This is something I've been wanting to know since you sent me that photo, you know, weeks and weeks ago. I've been wanting to hear how it was done.
Okay. So, Alan, I do believe we had listeners who actually like hearing me talk about photography. So.
Yes, we actually had people saying, more tips from Bart, more tips from Bart. So this is fun.
Excellent. Okay. I believe, do we want to discuss our funny time shifting we're about to engage in?
Well, maybe we'll do that on the next show.
Okay. I'm going to talk to the listeners in a week and you in 2 days.
Right. Oh, now you let on.
We're not going to be able to talk about Security Light next week because...
Oh, well, you never know.
After tomorrow.
you never know. Something interesting could happen this afternoon.
It's not here. It's already 8 o'clock in the evening. 9 o'clock
true.
In the evening.
That's true. All right. Well, close this out, Bart.
Okie dokie. Until very shortly. Wait, no, that doesn't work. Happy computing anyway.
Well, it looks like it's that time of the show again where we must draw it to a close. The chat room is moaning and crying and bellyaching and begging me to go on longer, but I have to stop sometime. If you'd like to join in on the live show yourself, just head on over to podfeet.com/live at 5 p.m. GMT-8 on Sunday nights, also known as 5 p.m. Pacific time. The group in there is very friendly and lively, and I guarantee you'll have a good time, as long as Not Nurse Ratched doesn't do anything too weird. Anyway, in the meantime, be sure to keep those emails coming, especially the dumb questions, by sending them to allison@podfeet.com, and be sure to follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/podfeet. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.